argument in Rayer versus State Farm.
May it please the court. May it please the court. Rob Carey, 17177, on behalf of Pauline Rayer. It's pronounced Rye like in rye bread.
Thank you.
Rayer and Dr. Brucker in the putative class. The primary issue before the court today is whether or not the trial court erred in applying Rule 23 to the plaintiff's claims. Plaintiff's claims arose after their providers submitted bills to State Farm. These bills were submitted in compliance with the pending regulation, and what happened was, instead of using all available information to process the claims and determine whether those bills were reasonable or unreasonable, State Farm instead opted to run them through a database that collected similar providers or similar procedures charges, and which we alleged were skewed downward, manipulated to come to a lower number, and then pay at the 85th percentile. And just to be clear, the 85th percentile is not 85% of what doctors charge, or even the 85th doctor. What it is they would array charges, similar charges, and pick the 85th percentile, and that price of that item is what they would pay. And so before I go into the core liability issues that Rule 23 is concerned with, I'd like to remind you of three no-fault concepts. One is, it's the insurer's obligation to ascertain all available information and make a decision on reasonableness. It's their obligation. If they're going to investigate to find further information, it's their obligation to notify both the patient and the doctor. This is in regulation, the patient and statute, frankly. The patient and the doctor have to be notified of what they need, what they're doing to get it, and have to be updated every 30 days. And lastly, if they choose not to make a payment, they have to specify the specific reason or reasons for the denial. So when we turn to what happened here, the primary problem is the trial court did not consider the core liability proofs that were required for the claims plaintiffs brought in this case. And let me give you the two that are the easiest, the two that can be proven with class-wide proof. In other words, they don't fall prey to the issue of you need individualized proof of reasonableness to prove the liability concepts. The first one is that no investigation occurred. That's very easy. If they didn't look to all available information to do their investigation, they've violated the UCDPA, which is a violation of the No-Fault Act. The proof of that would be simply that they chose to rely exclusively on the database, which we alleged in the first page of our complaint, that they exclusively rely on the database, nothing else. That goes through, the number comes out, and it's repriced or it's paid in full if it's less than that amount. There are only two outcomes of all of the class's bills. They're either paid in full or they go to the exact amount of the repricer. There is no other analysis going on here, and that's what we've alleged.
Let me interrupt you there just a moment, Mr. Carey, and ask you this. With regard to your first core issue of class-wide liability, and I think if I'm understanding you correctly, you're saying that that core issue of class-wide liability is based upon the fact that State Farm relied solely on the database without conducting any further investigation.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes.
And isn't it correct, however, that Regulation 528 says that independent investigation of the claims will be made when appropriate?
Well, that's what it says for to establish a presumptive violation. 528 deals just with presumptive violations.
So how do we determine when that further investigation is appropriate in each particular case?
Well, I think you'd have to look at the facts. I think you'd have to look at the facts that State Farm is presenting in this case. Every chance they get, they scream, you cannot determine reasonableness without looking at a bunch of factors. Every factor out there is fair game to decide whether it's reasonable. I think the merits question that a jury should answer is whether or not simply looking at a database calls for more information.
But if you're even on the facts here, at least one of the bills, didn't they look at something else? I mean, they repriced based on the database, as I understand it. They sent a letter to the doctor. He sends back an explanation and makes his case. They consider that, and they still deny that
right.
particular bill. But so isn't that extra investigation in on that particular bill?
No.
Why?
It's not investigation at all, because they're shifting the burden. It's their responsibility to go out and find that information. They cannot go, you know what, we've ran this through a repricer, which is what everybody else around allegedly charges, assuming it's not corrupted. We've run this through the repricer, and we've seen what everybody else has charged. So we're going to pay you that amount at the 85th percentile, which is unilaterally selected. It's not some magic number that's reasonableness, because they, in fact, changed it to 90 later. So they pay that amount, and then they send the doctor a letter saying, you tell us why the balance should be paid. That's completely contrary to how the statute and the regulation is set up, Your Honor. What it's set up to do is to say, we pay, in fact, this is right in 7081. You pay the amount you concede is reasonable, and then you go out and figure out what proof you need to figure out whether the balance is reasonable. It's not, well, I'm going to pay the part I agree, and then I'm going to ship it off to the insured and have them go work it out and come back to me to see if I'll pay it. That's not how it's set up. And that's exactly what they did. So the fact that Dr. Brucker sent something in on one bill is meaningless. He can prove his claim on liability by showing they didn't do an investigation. And then what happens is, and this is why individual facts get subsumed and don't become relevant, is because when you do that, you move damages, reasonableness, to damages. And you can prove those with class-wide proof. Class as a whole damages or aggregate proofs are very common in this context. And what happens is the reasonableness gets addressed by the experts through random sampling. Some may be reasonable, some may not. But the issue becomes one of aggregate proof. And you can look at Newberg on class actions in section 10:5. It's not a problem. There is no due process problem. They can attack on aggregate proofs, they can attack our expert, but they don't have a right to go in and individually criticize everything when it's moved to the damages phase. But let me address the second concept, because it's not reasonableness is not in the damages phase, and that is this. The trial court completely disregarded the issue on PIFR. And when I use the term PIFR, I really mean the Collard case, Flatirons Paving, all of the cases that say, when you make a decision on denying coverage or paying a claim, you're limited in some way when you later try to contest that. In other words, you can't go out and simply start doing the investigation you should have done under the statute at the time you made the denial. Now, whether that is you're limited to the justification you gave in the denial, and you can expand on that, or whether that is you are limited to the facts known at the time of denial, those are merits questions. If we're right on those questions, or part of those questions, the evidence would be limited in a way that would permit class-wide proofs, because the only thing they could put on would be either evidence of UNC, usual and customary pricing, or evidence on the database. Both of those refer to third-party sources that are common to all class members. And the trial would be this, and I thought this was what was contemplated in the Ryer 1 decision, which is all of the insurers class-wide have proof of bills in there, and those are evidence of reasonableness. That can be their case in chief. That can be their proof. And then it's up to the defendant to come in and say, here's why our evidence of repricing is enough to overcome that, or it's sufficient to show reasonableness by itself. That can happen. It has happened, frankly. These cases have been tried. Not one court out there, except the courts in Colorado, have refused certification of these claims. 10 trial courts have certified them.
How about an appellate court? Has there been an appellate court decision anywhere in the United States?
Yes.
On this issue?
Well, the Howe case that I supplemented as supplemental authority last week just came out a week or two ago, and it says you can certify these claims. That everything that the defendant is saying here to apply to this case relates to the merits of this case. So I think it was a Missouri case, Oklahoma case. The Oklahoma Court of Appeals said, yeah, exactly this case. In fact, in that case, it doesn't have the statutory touchstone of reasonableness. It says you have to pay usual and customary, so it's an even tougher case to certify, in my mind. And the Oklahoma case said, okay, defendants submitted a case, but the case they submitted cites to the very cases that put this in Colorado's court, which is there is an obligation to consider all available information, and it doesn't address the issue of can you preclude damages. So these cases have been certified routinely for good reason, because there are ways to do it class-wide. And so when you get into the PIFR issue, you start – actually, let me back up one sec, because I wanted to address one other issue the defendant raised on individualized proof, and that is the difference between reasonableness, which is whether the bill is reasonable or not, and reasonable proof of the fact and amount, the issue of what triggers the 30 days notice, which is a key point here. It's what distinguishes this case from Ammons, because that had no 30-day trigger. And the issue is they want to go in, they say they want to go in and challenge every class member's compliance with the statute, essentially, whether or not the bill complied with the statute. That doesn't happen here for a number of reasons. One is the statute And Ryer 1 didn't acknowledge this, but the statute existed at the time, or the regulation, rather. 528 says doctor's bills are presumptive proof of reasonableness. They're presumptive proof to trigger, presumptive proof of reasonable proof of the fact and amount. That triggers the 30 days. There is no indication from the record, nor did the defendant present any, that there's some problem with the bills that the doctor submitted. So absent that, it would be inappropriate to say that that's a non-predominant issue. But beyond that, they paid all these bills. They not only paid them, they said, here's what we're going to pay and here's what we're not going to pay. So you're trying to prove whether they knew of the bill and what the amount of the bill was, not whether it was reasonable, but what it was. Well, they clearly knew. They paid it. So that's water under the bridge. They say they want to go challenge everybody. They don't have a right to. If that were the case, you could never have a class action. There has to be some showing that there's an issue out there that destroys predominance that says, wow, we've got a real problem with these bills, assuming they all weren't paid, and that they're all so different and non-compliant that that's why we weren't paying these charges. But that's not what they said. They paid all the bills. They just paid a portion of them. So they've conceded necessity. They've conceded accident relatedness. They've conceded they know of the bill and the amount. And the only thing left is reasonableness. So I would just turn quickly to two other points. The standing issue on Ms. Ryer. Ms. Ryer has been indebted to the extent of $35 and perhaps even the amounts that were reimbursed inadvertently by the doctor. She has been out of pocket of monies for a substantial period of time, and she lost the time value of that money. She has had her doctor-patient relationship destroyed because State Farm refuses to do the investigation the statutes and regulations call for. She has standing to be in this case. She retains, and she alone retains, the right to pursue the statutory trebles and the penalties.
On the time value of money issue, did you raise that in the trial court? I know you raised it in your appellate brief. Was that an issue that you actually raised in the trial court?
Yes, it was. Yes, it was. And just to be clear, the doctor only repaid a couple of those bills,
I understand,
and there are a couple she's indebted on. And so the standing issue, first, clearly with any kind of monetary harm, they're standing, but it doesn't have to be monetary. It could be, I know LaBarren said declaratory relief isn't enough, but in a context where they are saying they're not going to make you whole and it's affecting the fabric of your relationship with your physician, you have a statutory right to have your rights declared. And if they're not complying with the statutes and regulations, you can have it addressed and you could have an injunctive element to the claim. On numerosity. I just touch real briefly on numerosity to make sure something's clear on that. The issue of the assignments can only increase the class membership. Okay? First, put aside that Ryer should have the statutory claims because only she can have it. She should have declaratory relief, and by Ryer, all class members. They have those rights. But when you take a claim, if you have as the claimant is the only class member, that's the smallest number you'll get. If you start making assignments, if you only have one doctor, then it's a person-for-person exchange. But if you give assignments to multiple providers, which happens all the time, the number goes up. The class membership will grow. They will each have a smaller portion of the claim, but they'll each have standing to be in the class. And I raise that to say just this. If you're doing a reasonable estimate of who has standing here and how many people are affected by the conduct, it's substantially more than the 13,000. An assignment doesn't mean people go away. It just changes who has the rights to be in the class. With that, I'd like to reserve the balance of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Carey. You've got about a minute and 17 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court. Michael McCarthy, registration number 6688, appearing on behalf of Appalese State Farm. With me is my colleague Sarah Mastelier. The most salient point that I can leave with this court in terms of the argument here today is that the positions that are being articulated by the appellants in this case are disconnected from and contradicted by the factual record that was developed at a two-day evidentiary class certification hearing that was held before Judge Kolomitz in La Junta in August of 2008. And the opinion of this court in Ryer 1 by Judge Hawthorne remanded, it reversed the summary judgment that had been entered by Judge Kolomitz, and it remanded for an evidentiary hearing consistent with accepted practice in Colorado on class certification. What that evidentiary hearing showed without rebuttal in the testimony was that State Farm did not exclusively rely on the database. And on the contrary, the testimony of Russell Kyle, and this can be found at volume one of the transcript of the evidentiary hearing at pages 220 and 221. What Mr. Kyle specifically testified to was that the bills that were submitted were sent to the Sloan's Lake operation, which applied the database that we're discussing here. There's no dispute about that. But the bills then came back to individual State Farm claims handlers, and the repricing number, if any, that was established by the database was then reexamined in each case as a matter of State Farm's systematic practice and considered in terms of the entire claim file. That was the testimony of Mr. Kyle at the evidentiary hearing. The fundamental premise upon which the class certification arguments are being advanced here by the appellant is that the only means that State Farm used, the sole means, was the application of the database. That has been flatly contradicted. Judge Kolomitz didn't reach the merits on that matter. But what this court has said in Unical, in an opinion by Judge Webb, is that there's a preponderance of evidence that's standard that applies to class certification proceedings. Preponderance of the evidence necessarily, in the context of an evidentiary hearing, implicates some preliminary weighing of the theory upon which the proponent of class certification is advancing certification. Their theory is founded upon the faulty premise that the only thing that State Farm did was to apply the database. And so the most important thing I can leave with the court is to implore the court to test that contention with the evidentiary record that was developed before Judge Kolomitz and the findings that Judge Kolomitz made. There was an exhaustive 27-page single-spaced order that Judge Kolomitz entered when he determined the class certification should be denied.
I have a question about the testimony and the record. Does it get into a level of specificity where it identifies any specific cases where the number from the database comes back to the examiner and the examiner doesn't actually reprice at that number?
The testimony did not speak to individual cases because we did not believe that in submitting the testimony at that level it was appropriate to go into individual cases. But what we did present through Mr. Kyle was evidence of what the system was, and the system did allow for those claims handlers to override the repricing and make a decision about whether the repricing, I think the testimony was, made sense in the context of the entire file. And if it was the claims adjuster had the authority to override that repricing, and the testimony was that they had the authority to do so, we didn't try to adduce testimony that in any particular instance a specific repricing number was changed. But we also adduced testimony, Your Honor, that established that there was an appeal process. And the appeal process was used with some regularity, and it was an appeal process of the repricing decision that State Farm sent out. And in fact, what effectively happened with Dr. Brucker here was when he sought to justify his bill by saying, I'm the only orthopod within 60 miles, that was considered and deemed to be an inadequate basis to overturn the repricing amount. But the testimony was that repricing amounts are in fact overturned in the appeals process, that in fact does happen. So what we have here is a situation where the factual record that was developed before the trial court and the findings that are entitled to an abuse of discretion standard of review do not support do not support the arguments that are being made in support of class certification here. The other points that I would make in terms of the argument that, you've heard from, appellant, it's evident from the briefs that the, parties very much disagree as to what the proper interpretation of this court's ruling in Pfeiffer is. We say that Pfeiffer stands for exactly the opposite of what is being advanced by appellants here, because in Pfeiffer there was evidence that was excluded by Judge Sandstead at the trial court in connection with a particular allowance of, no fault benefits. This court reversed that and said even though the holding, or I'm sorry, the notice to the claimant did not specifically rely upon this particular information, if that information was available to the insurer, that information can be, in fact, used to support that conclusion. So that's what Pfeiffer then does. The proper interpretation of Pfeiffer folds back into the core basis upon which class certification is inappropriate here, and that is under Rule 23b3, common issues do not predominate in this case because individual questions of reasonableness have to be responded. That notion really is embedded in Judge Hawthorne's decision in Ryer 1. And what Ryer 1 and this court's opinion relied upon heavily was the court's earlier decision in Klein. What Klein stands for and what this court confirmed in Ryer 1 was that just, again, it's just exactly the opposite of what you're hearing from appellant. A doctor's bill is not presumptive proof of reasonableness. A doctor's bill, if there is evidence that whether it comes from a database or otherwise, if it indicates that that charge is not reasonable for any number of reasons, then the insurer can in fact decline to pay, as State Farm did in this case, that portion of the charge that's deemed to be reasonable. And that's exactly what happened here. So Klein, there's some suggestion that maybe Klein isn't good law anymore because of the regulation issued by the Division of Insurance, 528. This court cited Klein with approval in Ryer 1, long after the promulgation of the regulation. So Klein, and it is ultimately for the judicial branch, not for the executive branch in the Division of Insurance, to determine what is adequate proof of reasonableness. And this court said that reasonableness is a fact question that needs to be determined on an individualized basis. So the core proposition of this case really runs squarely into the notion that's embedded in Klein, the notion that's embedded in Ryer 1, and this court's citation with approval of the Florida Court of Appeals opinion in Sestile, which says that sometimes a database accurately determines reasonableness, sometimes it doesn't. I'm going to turn, if I can, Your Honor, just if there are any other questions on class certification, I'm about to turn to the question of standing.
I have a question. You were speaking of Regulation 528, and I would like to ask what you think the effect is of the language, when appropriate, at the end of Reg 528 about investigating further than just using the database, as to the predominance of a class-wide liability issue or the commonality of a class-wide liability issue in this case, if any. Is there any, does that mean anything at all?
We believe, Your Honor, that it is meaningful. And that what when appropriate does is it underscores the variability that can occur in the normal processing of claims under 528. And when in many instances, the entire bill that was submitted by an insured claimant to State Farm for benefits were simply paid. And the when appropriate language essentially validates, we submit, what State Farm did here and what the testimony before the trial court established as far as how it handled claims.
What it did was it looked further when appropriate. And when appropriate, as a practical matter, on the testimony submitted by Mr. Kyle, indicated that whenever there was a repricing, the State Farm claims adjuster did in fact look, as the transcript of the hearing showed, looked at the entire claim file to determine whether that repricing that the database suggested in a preliminary way was appropriate. And so what that does in terms of class certification, to circle back to your question, is it establishes that there are the cases pervaded with individual questions of fact. The Ninth Circuit opinion that we submitted to by way of supplemental authority demonstrates that these issues are intrinsically individualized, and the reg supports that, and the language that you point out supports that, Your Honor.
In Mr. Kyle's testimony, did he talk at all about what's typically in a claim file? I mean, what if the only thing that's in there is the doctor's bill?
And I'm going to go on my memory here, Your Honor, but my memory was, I'd be on thin ice if I said, I mean, I know what's typically in a claims file because I work in this area a lot, but the what Mr. Kyle talked about was how everything that would be in a claims file would be considered, and I believe he alluded to the fact that there would be facts relating to the accident, there would be facts relating to other treatment from other providers. Typically in a PIP claim, you have not just a single provider, so you have a lot more information than just a single doctor's bill. I mean, you'd have the information regarding the basic accident and some basic the State Farm reaches out to the insured and asks them what the facts were of the accident when the claim is submitted. So I'm pretty confident in saying that you would almost never have a file that had nothing more than an application for PIP benefits and a doctor's bill. You would almost always have a much more fulsome picture of what was in fact involved. In terms of the standing issue, trial counsel's memory is always subject to deterioration over time, but the one thing that I want to say in response to a question that I think Your Honor asked about whether the time value of money question was raised before the trial court in the briefing on the motion to dismiss on standing grounds, our strong recollection is that the time value of money was not raised before the trial court in the briefing, that the time value of money actually issue didn't come up in class certification briefing either. I'm subject to correction on this, but I'm pretty confident in my memory on that. And that really the time value of money came up only in the briefing that we saw in this court.
I think the parties complied with CAR 28K and let us know where that issue was raised below.
If at all, below. Understand, Your Honor. The trial court found, in terms of its dismissal of Ms. Ryer, that she had assigned all of her insurance benefits. To adopt the position that would be advanced by the appellant would require this court, really, I believe, as a matter of first impression, to in effect split her claim and to say that, well, the contractual right to recover insurance benefits, in fact, did go to Dr. Ryer, but I still retain the ability to pursue penalties. The only instances in which that kind of splitting has even been contemplated is a situation where there was an equitable subrogee. And this was a direct assignment where Dr. Brucker stood in the shoes of the claimant. And it's not an equitable subrogee case.
Thank you, Mr. McCarthy.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Mr. Carey, you've got a little time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, just to clarify one comment, the regulation 528 presumptively shows reasonable proof of the fact and amount. It doesn't show reasonableness, but it is also evidence of reasonableness under Klein and Ryer 1. That's what I meant to say if I said something different. On the issue of did the database, was that the exclusive means to make a determination here? First, it's in our complaint. It's our theory of the case. Ryer 1 acknowledges we have information sufficient to have a jury make that finding. It's inappropriate at a class certification proceeding to determine that we're wrong on the merits, and that's precisely what he just asked you to do. We have evidence. That's for a jury to decide. That's the very merits question that can't be decided in class certification. The same thing is true on the Pfeiffer case. There are fact issues there of what was the basis for denial. How did it get denied? There are issues of law there that have to be decided. The appropriate approach is to certify the claim, send it back to the judges to certify class, and decide those merits questions. On, real quickly, on your question, Judge Hawthorne, on the how do you read the when appropriate, you have to keep in mind the obligation to investigate on all available information is in the UDCPA. So you have that obligation. So you don't know if it's appropriate till you know what all the other information is. You certainly can't take a database based on UNC and say, well, I didn't look at anything else, so how would I know if it's appropriate? Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Carey. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. Case will stand submitted. We'll issue an opinion in due course. That concludes our 9 o'clock docket for this morning. Counsel and Carey case are excused. We're going to take a very short recess, about 5 minutes, and then we'll proceed with the one case on our 10 o'clock docket. So the bailiff can announce a recess.
All right. The court will be in recess.